Now we have the first meeting of questions and answer questions.
Hold the question out to you. So.
Thank you. I'm Kenny Dowell from the University of Nottingham. I'd like to say I very much enjoyed your paper. But I'm second to no one in my defense of free markets. But I want to come back to what I think here is the fundamental institutional problem, which is the fact that on the one hand, we don't have institutions that avoid kicking the can down the road. And on the other hand, we have predatory governments. And so the kind of hint in your paper was that we should go for a free market solution, something like what Cato would propose. And I've been looking at these things for about 14 years, and I'd like to make three points. First off, DC pension scheme, if you actually calibrate it, the numbers come out horrendously low. And in our first pension metrics simulation, you save what you think is a reasonable amount, you get a pathetically low expected pension, and it's extremely risky. The risk balance, there's a range of uncertainty. And these are just the known unknowns, not the unknown unknowns, are horrendously bad. And then on our subsequent recalibrations of the model, things get much, much worse when you allow for longevity risk, which is racing at an enormous rate, as Professor Tansey pointed out. And secondly, when you reduce the equity premium in the simulations. So that's the first thing, that the obvious sort of free market thing is very poor. Nonetheless, I've got a proposal at the end, which is very primitive, but I think probably works. The second point I would make is that when you have a free market in these, well, I say free market, but I'm thinking here of the British system, which is a grotesque parody of a free market. What we actually find is that essentially it becomes a rip-off charter for the industry to totally exploit the customers. And so we're just about to produce a report in which basically it says that the driver in your DC pension is the contribution rate, is the charge by the industry, and the industry lies through its teeth. And the asset allocation, how you invest, is trivial in comparison with the effects of the charge. So we have a problem, is how can you stop the industry ripping off people in a system in Britain where the rule of law has collapsed and there's no accountability? Because look, if somebody missells you a pension, by the time you find out, he's dead, what are you going to do? So that's the kind of thing about kicking the can down the road irresponsibly. So, and the third thing is, suppose that you do it anyway, and you say you have to have very high contribution rates, etc., etc., and leaving aside the dangers of paternalism and all that, which are ever present, it's a racing surety that the government will simply steal the money down the road anyway. So in Britain, for example, and I don't think we are any more dysfunctional than most other countries, but we are highly dysfunctional. The government, on the one hand, is pushing people to save more, and on the other hand, it's looking at pension pots as ways of subsidising infrastructure development and so forth. So, how can you possibly imagine that 40 years down the road, your pension, if you're responsible, will still be there for you? So then the question is, what do you do about it? And this is where I would offer a very primitive, in inverted commas, solution, which I observe happening around me in Britain, which I call the Pakistani solution, which in essence is, you have a big family, you buy gold on the cash market and hide it. Yeah. And I challenge anybody to come up with a better strategy and avoid the two twin problems of predatory government and high charges.
Society, but I too, like everybody else, was struck by this
interesting question of who is to blame for the fact that we have these incessant promises of pensions which cannot really be financed beyond a certain point. Now, Professor Tansey said the problem is not the government, it's democracy. And I didn't know whether he was referring to democracy as an institution or whether he was referring to the people, that is, that the people are unsound. I was reminded of the year 1953, when, you may remember, there was trouble in the East German Republic, riots and so on. And Bertolt Brecht, the playwright, said, the solution is obvious. We must dissolve the people and elect a new one. This seems to be almost the only solution to the problem, because it's obvious that people want things they cannot have. And that's a major problem, and I suppose it's part of what these days is often called the crisis of democracy. And it raises many interesting questions that certainly need discussion, and no doubt we'll get it.
Can I just make a comment on applying the concept of failure to the crisis pension systems, which I frankly don't think is appropriate, because it's a different kind of failure of the Darwinian or Schumpeterian kind of failure, which is a very positive thing that you can definitely apply to individuals or enterprises. But when you apply to this context, it may lead to some confusion. I think probably the right concept is the concept of discontinuity, because the old systems are in a state of transition, and so you have this different kind of discontinuity. And I mean, my question would be, have you done any analysis of specific patterns of discontinuity? We're always experiencing discontinuities, and sometimes we're not aware of it. And have you made an analysis of different kinds of discontinuity? Because I think you have to take away the Soviet Union case. The Soviet Union case is not helpful in the discussion, because the Soviet Union case is a collapse, a sovereign collapse. Sovereign collapse is a tragedy. So you can't say positively something positive about the sovereign collapse. I think taking away the extreme mechanism, then you need to focus on how you have the transition. And so moving away from towards a multi-pillar system, where you really have to rebalance particularly the relationship between the first pillar and the second and the third pillar. So I know you get that. Now, in that sense, the essence, I really like, by the way, your paper. It's conceptually intriguing. And this concept of the break of the intergenerational contract, which is something which is happening, and we are not aware of it in many cases. I mean, in this country, there is a break of the intergenerational contract. It's a very strange kind of contract, by the way, because we really are making a contact with a future generation which are not there really to agree with our concept. So we make the term. And besides, it's very unfair, because I mean, we not only impose a burden on them, transferring to them the cost of the present day pension, but also we take away benefits from them. So it's a very strange way of redefining the social. But that's where we are. And I think to politically it's very clear. But also legally it's very true. Because there is the same thing when you mentioned the constitutional process. Sometimes we people speak in relation to benefits in terms of rights. And they think they have vested right in. And this is very inappropriate, because you are in a system where you have to redefine those rights, and you don't think in terms of rights for the rights of future. Sorry, I've been too wrong. But only one comment on referring to the case of Italy, where I think in the latest piece of reform, quite important one, we have introduced the defined contributions mechanism for everyone. And we have defended this for the first people. And we have defended this many reasons, because I think it would have an educational aspect, inducing people to think that what they say, what they pay, they contribute to the system, is in some sense related, must be related to what they have.
So I think we have been placing it as a mechanism for not only rebalancing and making the system valid, financially stable, but also as a way to somehow make people think in terms of their own. However, this has a drawback, because somehow it makes us all think that the first pillar is based on insurance benefits, which is not. The first pillar is basically a welfare system, and then Vito Lanzi's solution or any other solution is in terms of welfare. I mean, we can't go to a pre-Bismarck time, because I think it would not be acceptable politically in a democratic society not to have a minimum income after for old age. Whatever it is of a minimum income for the rest of the population, I think in democratic society, so you have to think in terms of having some kind of mechanism. But then I think, you know, you take away these concepts from the first pillar, while I think the first pillar should really be transition mode, be gearing towards establishing some kind of minimum pension mechanism for all, and the other two pillars should be really based on insurance or on savings principles. But anyway, I wanted to come back with you. I think it's very intriguing for this time.
Thank you. Thank you for the comments. Well, I've been researching mostly and experiencing the Lithuanian system of failure, where, like I mentioned, the debt has gone from 0% in 2008 to 10.5% today. And I think one of the we have a paradoxical situation that in Lithuania only 14% of people believe that the pensions that they will receive will be enough to cover their needs. And we just recently did a survey of people's opinion, and we compared how many people believe in aliens and how many believe that they will live from their state pensions. So 38% believe in aliens and 14% believe in pensions. So twice as many people believe in aliens that they have never seen, or, well, some have seen, I don't know. And the problem then is that people do not believe, but at the same time, they do not save. They think, well, the state is still there, and some politicians will do something. And when you have debates with politicians, and we at the Lithuanian Free Market Institute say that, look, there's no reason to believe that the situation will improve. How will you return this debt? Nobody knows. But the politicians, they have this calm attitude, and they say, don't listen to them. They and their free market ideology are misleading the people. The state will always be there, and it will always have some money. The pension funds, they may have zero, and the state will always have some money, and it will distribute some money. If it were to distribute only as much as it has, that would be fine. But the problem is it goes into debt, and nobody has an answer how they're going to solve it.
Can I make a comment?
Yes.
About alien pensions. I think it's rational to believe in aliens, but it's irrational to believe in pensions.
Yeah.
There are.
Yeah, too.
Well, I was thinking about what can arise in the survival mind for the two meanings of democracy. A democracy is the election of the politicians that make all the damages that you describe. But democracy is also what the people want. So what people want, how can that be wrong? And is that correct?
More or less.
So when you were saying we have to distinguish between failure of democracy and failure of the pension systems, which are different things. And it's difficult to find a solution because personal savings, example of Japan, failed. Insurance company, well, then you have to insure the insurance company, and it gets complicated. Probably what Professor Pansy suggested is a good compromise. The legal system in Italy is not such a bad compromise. But if you look really at the bottom line, is that you want to be insured against the hazards of life. And perhaps be insured against life itself. And neither market nor democracy can make that. Not the market, because the market is not meant for that. And the risk is inherent in the functioning of the market. So basically, this question relates to a definition of democracy. It is, what is democracy? If democracy is to provide something that is deeply in our feelings, in our meaning, in our conscience, that democracy is that if you live and work in a society, this will, in a way, provide some protection against the worst hazards of life. And I think this could be a definition of democracy.
Women are never looked at or taken. On that combative note, I think Charles on it. I'm Jane Fuller from the Centre for the Study of Financial Innovation in the UK. I'm also actually a pension fund trustee in the UK. Probably more written on this subject. A couple of things you should look at. The Australian scheme is a very interesting one of compulsory contributions to a national pension scheme made by employees and employers, which is written, the contribution rate is now about 9% for employees and 50% for employers. This scheme is then invested. So I think you've also got to, I think pay as you go, I would have thought just had it system other than through general taxation, as Mr. Tansy said, which then pays out a minimum of that, universal benefit as a state pension. So the interesting question is whether the money goes into a large state scheme that's then invested in the conventional fund management industry, or whether you have a Dutch system, and the Dutch is possibly the best employment-based system, whereby you have big industry-wide schemes. They have lots of economies of scale, in-house expertise, rather than that they want to buy derivatives, they do that in-house, rather than doing it very expensively through hedge funds outside. It's very strict minimum funding requirements, in terms of not letting a deficit develop, so the Dutch scheme is well worth looking at. Then the UK is having a slightly weird experiment with a national pension scheme, but it doesn't have compulsory, it's auto-enrollment. You can opt out, whereas the Australian one, it's a big saving if you make it compulsory. Not popular, but if the thing doesn't have to be marketed, that's a big saving. You can't mis-sell something that's compulsory, so that's also quite interesting in terms of doing this thing. If you're thinking about individual defined contributions or individual pension savings, that is getting... first of all, I should say Ken's absolutely right in terms of charges, but that is now getting very transparent, should be, because there's been so much written about, as he says, the sort of rip-off. But you are now getting much cheaper schemes whereby you can invest in things directly. And the other thing, of course, to think about is lots of countries have all sorts of tax rebates putting money into these pension schemes. So the UK, you're a 40% taxpayer. At the moment, you can put in £3. Let's say it'll take it up to £5. Even if they cut it, as they're threatening to do, you'll still put in £4 and the state will make that up to £5. So there's lots of there's lots of ways to make personal saving and individual schemes attractive, but they are the ones that are the most prone to high charges. And of course, an interesting question as well about pooling. Because you get an economy of scale through pooling into a big investment fund, and you get an economy of scale through pooling the risk. And one of the expenses of defined contribution is all these little individual costs can be expensive as well, even though in some ways it looks like a better route to personal responsibility. But that's just a few of the things that you might look at. Congratulations on your paper, and on writing it well as well.
Thank you. In terms of the charges of the private pension funds, we have been having these debates in Lithuania as well, and actually I think next week or the week after that we will have we may have our law changed, and the maximum charges that we already have caps on maximum charges, and they would be reduced, but I don't think that is a good option. Because then at the end of the day, well, we have such an unpredictable environment in Lithuania where politicians can change them, the law any day. Yes, the charges are high, but the alternative to lower them will leave only two market players. We have around seven market players, two of them are very big. If you lower the charges, the small companies will go bankrupt. And so then customers may have some benefit from lower charges, but the competition will be eliminated from the market.
Okay.
I think there was a question there.
Well, just a comment about the Scandinavian system. Because for many reasons, I'm quite familiar with that. It was supposed to be the most, generous, even if paid with a very, very high taxation. But the system failed, not the system again. Even the social welfare state failed with the failure of the banking system and the financial crisis in the 90s. They introduce a lot of corrections under age and so on. But as a matter of fact, what they did is they managed to change the economic system. So they now have higher growth, higher productivity, higher natality, balanced budget, and surplus in the external surplus. Do you think these are artificial corrections to the system, or there are, the natural the cost of corrections to the system? And according to them, this kind of, if it's gonna go on in the future, it could guarantee the system for the next generation. And to me, it's natural. One generation. It's not, I don't know if they can, but anyway, do you think that this is connected with a real spatial situation, or can we have higher growth, higher productivity, higher natality, and so on, even in other European countries?
I think, yes, probably it is possible, and there have been periods when European countries have been growing a lot, but like Mr. Tanzi was saying, the problem of rising longevity, it is a paradox that as states, as nations become wealthier, the strain on their welfare systems, on their public pension systems grows. If the goal of those systems is to provide some minimum assistance, I think as in a way as it is described in Denmark, then the richer people are, the more they have saved up, the lower is the strain on the budget. If the pension benefits are partially means tested as they are in Denmark, the richer you are, the smaller the burden on the state. But with the design of the Bismarck systems, the richer you are today when you pay in your contributions, the bigger your pension would have to be in the future, regardless of the situation in the future. That's why the debate of whether it is a crisis of democracy, well, both the Beveridgian system and the Bismarckian system, they're both in democratic countries. but the design is very different. So I think at the end of the day, it is a crisis of the Bismarckian system, where the spending and where the benefits reflect past realities, past economic realities, not the realities that we have today. The spending depends on somebody's past income rather than the current economic situation.
I come back to the democracy question again. Aristotle and the Greeks believed you couldn't really have democracy because it was a system by which the poor would plunder the rich. We have nonetheless succeeded in having democratic states in Europe for the last 100, 150 years, and the poor have not exactly plundered the rich. But what we are now finding, I think, is that there is an increasing tendency for people to vote for parties promising welfare under the illusion that the people who will pay for this are the people who are rich. The question then becomes, why has democracy worked pretty well for 150 or so years? And the answer, I think, is that it was a system, a formal system of government superimposed upon a fairly bourgeois society in which the rule of law was well established and there was quite a strong, as it were, bourgeoisie who had themselves important votes. So I think the problem of democracy is in part that we are running out of many of the customary moral safeguards that tended to operate over the last 150 years but are weakening with every generation.
Maybe could I make a comment on that, because that's interesting. But if you look at the system as it worked in the last, by the way, the social systems, are not 150 years; are much younger than that. They really start with Roosevelt and Beveridge, so we are talking about 70 years. Keynes wrote this famous book in 1926 called The End of Laissez-Faire, where he started really arguing that the role of the state should change. But until that time, we really did not have a major development in the pension area. Even Roosevelt, even Bismarck, as I mentioned, had a very minimal impact, and the state was not very much involved, except as a bureaucracy, no? But then from the 40 on, from the 40 to the 90, we have this tremendous expansion of the social state, where public spending went from 15-20%, went to 40, 50 or even more than 50% in many countries. At the time, for a long time, there was the feeling that the richer people were contributing more. The taxes were highly progressive. You remember the famous Beatles song, The Tax Man, which has said, I'll tell you how it will be, one for you, 19 for me, because I'm the tax man. Because the marginal tax rate at the time was 95%. Today would be unthinkable of any country having a marginal tax rate. But then in the 80s, things started changing. The clear the limit of this welfare state system began to be apparent. They became apparent very quickly in the north of Europe, where there were major, major crises in the 80s and beginning of the 90s. And there was adjustment there. And then progressively we have seen, the impact of democracy began to be much more evident now than it was probably 50 years ago. And we, for the reason probably that we are no longer going after the rich. Now the redistribution has become across the it's not quite clear, in fact, which way it goes. It's not.
May I reply? Just one fast reply.
reply to that. When I said the coming of democracy, I was referring, I suppose, in a parochial kind of way to British experience with the first Reform Act in 1832 and various voting systems which were spreading throughout the 19th century. The pensions problem indeed comes two generations or more later, but that's after democracy has been established for a generation or two.
Yeah, yeah.
I would like to go back to Craig Hunt's paper, actually. And one of the previous professors recommended her to take out the example of USSR. And maybe because I was born in the USSR, but I understand completely where Craig Hunt comes from and why she wanted to have it in the paper. And the point that she made about the solution that one generation has to decide to sacrifice. And just get out from the system. To be honest, maybe because I ended up after the collapse of Soviet Union in Russia, and that's where I grew up, I feel like my generation, the generation of people who were born in the USSR, and then grew up in Yeltsin Russia, and then found themselves in Putin's Russia, is exactly the generation that didn't have a chance to choose, but was chosen by themselves to get out from the system. Because you were born in the system and in a country that doesn't exist. Then you grew up in the system which gave you a lot of freedom and gave you some sort of hope, but then the system also disappeared. And also that kind of state disappeared. And so if you ask the people from my generation, of Russians exactly, Ukrainians a little bit different system, in a little bit different situation because you have a sort of a security from European Union, Russians don't have it. That's what you actually do. That's exactly what my generation is doing. We do not rely on the state because we don't believe in the state. It's a dictatorship. You cannot trust it. Your parents actually didn't earn their salary, their pension, because when they started to work, it was still the USSR. Then it collapsed. So all the pensions that they earned that time disappeared. Then the new state came, and it was a total chaos, so they also didn't earn anything. So even a person is earning in Russia, let's say, $1 billion a year, his pension from the state will be $300, you know. It's just completely different level. And that's why we grew up, my generation, grew up the way that you have to take care of your parents, and you have to take care of yourself. And there is no state that will provide you anything. So we were not given a choice of getting out from the system or, you know, saving the whole state, but we have to. And that's why I'm really happy to hear it in your paper and in your presentation, because I felt like you were talking about me. Thanks.
Thank you. Of course, the sad thing is that the countries that could have gone for the solution where there was no state pension system still decided to honor the obligations in return for the same promise that they may not pay back in return. So even though Lithuania or Russia could have gone to a system where they would pay the pensions of the current retirees and not have anything else in place, they reinvented the wheel and put in the same pension systems, unfortunately.
Maybe I could just add one very brief that Russia has the great advantage vis-a-vis other countries. That is the only country in the world that I know, or one of the very few countries where life expectancy is falling. So